This past Friday, Governor Bob Holden signed a bill into law to ban same-sex marriages in the state of Missouri. The Associated Press reported that Holden signed the legislation in private, saying he, quote, wanted to spare the state the battle of discussion over this, end quote. Limits on the rights of homosexuals have also become an issue in the debate over President Bush's proposal to give federal funds to faith-based charities, including those which have a policy of not hiring gays. And the Supreme Court recently ruled that the Boy Scouts could exclude homosexuals. In a dissenting opinion, Justice John Paul Stevens wrote that the real issue in the case was not that a scout was gay, but that he had not hidden his sexual orientation. That distinction makes gay rights cases different from legal battles over race or gender discrimination, as Yale Law School professor Kenji Yoshino writes in a forthcoming issue of the Yale Law Journal.
Gay rights, in a fundamental way, differ from the preceding model of civil rights that was set down by the race-based and feminist civil rights movements. Because an underlying premise of both of those movements was that assimilation is a good thing. And the reason that racial minorities and women are so vulnerable is that they can't change or hide the trait that marks them as different. Racial minorities can't change or hide their skin color, and women can't change or hide the fact that they look like women. But I think the gay case is fundamentally different in that it shows us that assimilation can be not just an escape from discrimination, but also precisely the effect of that discrimination. And what I'm trying to say by that is that often the forms of discrimination that gays encounter takes the form of asking gays to hide or give up their identity in one of three ways. One is to convert, i.e., go into conversion therapy and become straight. One is to pass, you know, you can be gay, but just don't say that you're gay. And the final one, which I think is the hardest to get your head around because I think it's relatively unknown as a term, is covering. And covering is a 1960s sociologist Irving Goffman's term for you can be gay and say that you're gay, but don't put it in our face. You know, make it easy for us to ignore. And so these are three forms of assimilation that gays have encountered as demands from mainstream society. And these assimilationist demands are not experienced as, oh, if I do this, I can escape discrimination. They're experienced as themselves discriminatory in nature. And so that's why I think gay civil rights is fundamentally different from race-based or feminist civil rights.
So your argument is that behavior ultimately, in terms of freedom, makes us who we are. And therefore,
In part, really.
Well, how do you prove that conduct is essential to identity, proving it in a court of law?
I think that when you're trying to prove something in a court of law, often what you're adverting to, either explicitly or implicitly, is how people order their lives, what people on the street think. If I were trying to make this argument generally to a judge, you know, if I could sit down with a judge, I think I might start asking questions like, do you think that there might be some behaviors that are so connected to an individual's identity that they might actually be constitutive of that identity? And some examples that I might play with would be examples like homosexual sodomy in the case of gay people. Currently, some laws, like the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, make a very clear distinction between status and conduct, saying it's okay to be gay in the military, just don't engage in homosexual conduct. Well, that to me seems like a very, very unstable distinction, in that I think if you asked 100 people on the street, the vast majority of them would say that there is some connection between being gay and engaging in homosexual sodomy. Mm-hmm. Similarly, the Supreme Court has said, not with regard to Title VII, which is the congressional statute, but with regard to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, that pregnancy is not an issue of sex discrimination, that it is said pregnancy is not sufficiently related to sex to be analyzed as sex discrimination. Now, again, I would say that for the vast majority of people, if you ask them, does pregnancy have anything to do with being a woman, I think that most people would say yes. Finally, in the race context, the Supreme Court has said that language, speaking Spanish, this is an actual case, is not sufficiently tied to being Hispanic, that discrimination on the basis of language can be cognized as discrimination on the basis of race. And again, I think that if you asked people, like, does being Spanish have anything to do with Latino or Latina identity, I think that most people would say yes. In some ways, I'm trying to make the law less kind of mathematical and logical and more accountable to the way in which we live our lives.
The law is accountable in this country to the Constitution. Is there constitutional ground for equal protection on the basis of conduct or behavior?
There is, actually. What's really been interesting is that in the recent past, the Supreme Court has seemed to, not yet in majority opinions, but in concurrences, that there's been a concurrence in the case that I was alluding to earlier, a plurality opinion by Justice Kennedy, in which Justice Kennedy says that the concept of race might actually incorporate, in some instances, language. There are pockets already within the equal protection jurisprudence that I think could be expanded under which race discrimination or sex discrimination or orientation discrimination could be expanded to incorporate the behaviors in which such individuals engage.
What cases are you looking at now to observe, examine, test some of your theories in terms of equal protection jurisprudence?
Well, I'm particularly interested in the gays in the military instance. But I think that Don't Ask, Don't Tell provides a particularly useful instance in that I think people get really mad when they understand the policy and they think that the distinction that the policy rests on is really implausible. Again, the distinction that the policy rests on is you can be gay, you just can't engage in any kind of homosexual conduct without getting kicked out of the military, including homosexual sodomy. And I think that people think, well, this is an instance in which the law is just being silly, in which the law is not being true to the way in which we live our lives, which is that when we encounter gay people, we think that one of the great things about them is that they, or one of the terrible things about them is that they actually engage in same-sex sexual acts, right? So to say that being gay doesn't have anything to do with your homosexual acts is very problematic. And again, there have been dissents and concurrences and non-majority opinions that have highlighted this fact, saying that homosexual conduct is so constitutive of homosexual identity that burdening homosexual conduct is tantamount to burdening homosexual status.
Do you expect those arguments to be made then when these cases come up?
Yes. In fact, they have been made. And so far, they've been rejected by the majorities in these opinions, but they have been picked up in dissents. And very often what happens in the law is that arguments that get made in dissents get picked up by later majorities.
So you expect the dissenting opinion written by John Paul Stevens in the ruling last year that the Boy Scouts of America could exclude gays. He said that the issue was that a scout had decided not to hide his orientation. And he said his openness, I'm quoting, his openness is the sole and sufficient justification for his ostracism, which amounts to, again, I'm quoting, a constitutionally prescribed symbol of inferiority.
Right. I am very hopeful that Justice Stevens' words will get picked up. I mean, frankly, I think that gay rights is really moving forward in this country. So absent a backlash, I do expect the courts to begin protecting gays more and more. And I think that one of the places in which they'll start is precisely with this idea of saying that you have the right to be gay, but not the right to say that you're gay or to engage in homosexual conduct is not a very stable or helpful distinction. And I feel like that's what Justice Stevens is saying.
Kenji Yoshino is a law professor at Yale University. His article on equal protection is scheduled to appear in an upcoming issue of Yale Law Journal. He joined us from Yale University. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.